air, and it's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and narrow-minded progressives. Welcome to you, too. And also, you latent liberal haters, welcome to you. And, of course, just regular folks, good morning to you as well. Mark Riley, how are you? I was about to say, Mark Maron, good morning to you. I'm like, wow, I'm really detached today.
How you doing, man?
I'm all right, dude.
You psyched to go to Boston?
I'm very excited to go to Boston tomorrow. It might snow or something. I don't know, man. Yeah, but snow's cool. It'll be fine.
As long as you ain't got to drive through it.
We're not driving. We're taking the train.
You spent 10 minutes yesterday talking about how bad the Massachusetts drivers were.
Yeah.
I don't want to get killed going up
there.
We're going
to be on the train from Rileytown up Boston, Massachusetts. Somerville, Massachusetts. We'll be coming to you live Someday Cafe in Davis Square, Somerville. Our guests are going to be Barney Frank, the congressman, of course. Jimmy Tingle, the comedian. The musician Ted Leo. Barry Crimmins, the writer slash comedian. No tickets are necessary. Just come by, have a cup of coffee, hang out. We'll talk to you. We'll throw you a t-shirt if we got one, maybe a keychain or something while supplies last. And Friday night I'll be performing at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway theater in Davis Square right there as part of the Ding Ho reunion, 25 years of the best of Boston comedy. I've been to Boston a long time, but I did start there on some level.
We got written up in one of the Boston papers, too.
We did?
I think it was the Boston Herald.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, they got a picture of you.
No.
The whole nine, man.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, can we get it up on this newfangled machine I have
here? I don't know. My wife had it up on the computer. I don't know what it is with you and her. But she had it up on the computer, and I'm looking at it. Hey, that looks like Marin. Sure enough, there's a write-up about the whole Ding Ho thing, about the broadcast, everything.
Wow, I'm here to tell you that I don't know what's up with me and your wife either. I have no idea. It's coming from your house.
Are you up, honey?
She's up. Maybe she is. Maybe she's not.
I don't know.
So, I went on a Puffins bender last night, which was sad. Yeah. You see, you're looking at
what's
me confused, Caleb.
What's that?
You think I'm speaking in some weird term, like, you know, hey, hit me to this Puffins thing. Puffins is a sad cereal. It's a health food cereal made by Barbara's health food whatevers. I like Puffins and Grain Shop made by Barbara's. So I just got into this compulsive cycle where I just had bowl after bowl of Puffins with vanilla soy milk. And that's where I was, you know, sitting there with my cats eating Puffins. How's that picture? Huh? What do you think of that? Huh? What do you think? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my
just
God.
Just me and a bowl of Puffins and my cats. Wondering what's happened. Well, how did I get here? Yeah. So I made a mistake yesterday on the air, and I'm trying to be. This was just one of those weird kind of pacing. I was in a rant of some sort, and I said that the Bush family had a relationship with Macmillan Press, and it's not. It's actually McGraw-Hill, and we've talked about it before. McGraw-Hill actually published one of their subsidiaries did the Pet Goat. And the Bush family has a really long history with McGraw-Hill, which is frightening in the context of that they're trying to change. The school board of Texas is trying to reshape textbooks to say that it'll tweak all these marriage and sex references and, you know, get rid of words like partners and, you know, make sure it's man and woman, make sure that all the relationships that are being talked about are monogamous and forever, and just to make sure it's very clear that in the textbooks there are no partners, there are only men and women, there is no gay, there is no anything. And that's coming out of Texas, which is where McGraw-Hill is. And apparently, the amount of cross-pollination and mutual admiration between the administration and McGraw-Hill is pretty profound. Harold McGraw Jr. sits on the National Grant Advisory and Founding Board of the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy. McGraw, in turn, received the highest literacy award from President Bush in the early 90s for his contributions to the cause of literacy. But what's really frightening is this is one of the largest manufacturers of textbooks for schools in the world. And as you were saying, yes, it is a money thing, but once they let the Christo-fascist, you know, zombie brigade of the neocon death cult infiltrate this level, you know, have influence over these books, when it comes down to business, and, you know, the frightening thing about, you know, privatization and monopolies is that they can pretty much monopolize the brains of all these kids with this crap, you know, this sort of narrow-minded, religious-oriented crap that should be, you know, not be in an educational curriculum. You know, I mean, we're talking, it should be a fact-based education. It should be an embracive education. You know, it should be a tolerant education, one that, you know, provides an education of human rights, not like, not, not, and, It scares me, man. I get to the point where I don't understand, you know, what price, you know, we are really going to pay as a country because of this, you know, infiltration of the local governments and the propaganda machine.
A deep deer
of the price. Christo fascist zombie brigade of the neocon death cult, my friend.
We are going to, believe me, it's going to be up to parents at a point to provide this education for their children. When I say this education, I'm talking about what has up until now been a traditional education, an education that talks about tolerance, about different people from different places, an education that gives children a worldview. None of that is going to be in any of these textbooks in another 20 years.
And that's why some people, it was a mistake we made not too long ago about homeschooling, is that a lot of people who homeschool are actually doing it in reaction to this. I mean, there are Christian homeschoolers who are homeschooling to give their kid an extreme sort of narrow education in order to make sure that they don't, you know, behave in a way that they find morally reprehensible, you know. But there's also these other people that are reacting to the type of education, to the lack of responsibility, you know, in educational systems, because the educational systems have sort of decayed so much since Reagan.
Oh, yeah. Well, the education systems across the country, starting with that, what was that, Proposition 13 in mm-hmm. California back in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There have been, you know, when you tie education directly to a tax, like people, most localities do to property taxes,
mm-hmm.
you leave yourselves vulnerable to people who got a lot of money, who don't have any kids, and who object to paying into a system that they don't essentially use. So what ends up happening is, you know, property taxes rise at a certain level, but people object, and education funding, as the property taxes rise, state funding for education starts to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, you've got education shortfalls that these school districts all over America can no longer fill.
And this is like the only hope that we have to make this culture better, you know, is with these kids in a lot of ways, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in terms of, you know, of how they come up and what they think is important. And the thing that creeps me out about this, do you think, I know you talk about it in terms of money, but do you think that, you know, years ago when the McGraw-Hill Publishing House was developing a relationship with George Bush Sr., you know, in terms of business, do you think that this agenda, that the sort of fanatical Christian agenda that's going to be inserted into textbooks, is this part of a broader plan, or do you think this is a coincidence?
No, I think it's more recent than George Bush Sr. In other words, when those alliances were made with Poppy,
right,
that was money.
Right.
That was about, look, this is what we need, this guy,
right.
This is, you know, that sort of thing. I think what they've done has begun, I think they've begun to adapt to the fact that Son Bush, the current president, has a different agenda than his old man.
Has an army of the zombie brigades.
He will sit back and act as though he has nothing to do with any of this.
Mm-hmm.
He will sit back and say, well, no, that's, you know, that's my health and human services, or that's my education guy, you know, and essentially say, well, hey, we're kicking out the money. We've implemented No Child Left Behind. The fact of the matter is that George Bush and his ilk have an agenda to eventually defund public schools, put more and more kids into, in essence, religious schools, give those kids religious education, and what they've done, their allies have now created higher education so that these kids can walk a seamless line from kindergarten through law school.
God, this is so dangerous. But you know who couldn't act like he didn't know what was going on? Rumsfeld yesterday. That was beautiful. That guy, you know, the Sergeant Thomas Wilson,
mm-hmm.
You know, he put Rumsfeld, you know, who is obviously one of the kingpins of the neocon death cult, on the defensive, backpedaling, didn't have an answer, stumbling over himself. It was beautiful. Could not take responsibility. It was great. And he was on the spot, and it was perfect. I think we got sound of that, don't we, Kalo?
I think we do.
Like number one, dude.
Our soldiers have been fighting in Iraq for coming up on 3 years. A lot of us are getting ready to move north relatively soon. Our vehicles are not armored.
We'll hear Rumsfeld's response right after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Waging a war of words against stupidity.
Morning Sedition
on Air America Radio.
Where would we be? Where would we be without the internet, man? You know, here, like, Kayla doesn't know what Puffins is. Riley's like, what's Puffins? Is that the stuff that comes in the clear bag? No. So, like, thank God for technology. I just did a Google search on puffins. But, you know, enough. Let's get back to the puffins. They're not the greatest cereal in the world, but it's a very addictive. You know what? I'm not going to sit here and talk about puffins because we've got Rumsfeld on hold. Hold on, Chris. That is not the site. That's the bird puffins. Those are like penguins.
Reaffirmed his faith in human nature.
Oh, no, the PETA people are going to be all over me. How can you dare eat puffins? Puffins are an almost extinct bird that look like penguins. Hey, let's hear that Rumsfeld's response to specialist Thomas
Since
Wilson.
The Iraq conflict began, the Army has been pressing ahead to produce the armor necessary at a rate that they believe, it's a greatly expanded rate from what existed previously, that they believe is the rate that is all that can be accomplished at this moment.
I had no idea that any of you would have the nads to ask me a question that really made a difference. Wow, that's really strange. Don't you guys know how to follow orders? I'm here to just placate you into thinking we're behind you. Don't confront me with facts. He also said, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have. What is this?
What crap is that?
I thought we were at, outside the fact that I don't think we should be in Iraq, I think that, we're supposed to have the best army in the world. That's how they pitch it on the commercials. Be an army of one. You're going to have to bring your own gear. Yeah, I mean, what is that? I mean, this is supposed to be the best army. And this guy asked a reasonable question. Why can't you? And then he went on to say, we're churning out as many as we can, right? And then what was the other thing he said that was amazing? You can have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can still be blown up. What a rationalization. Well, I bet you that made the guys feel better. Oh, okay. All right, so you're right. Maybe we should just walk around naked, you dummy. What is that?
How about you put him in a tank and run him down? What's the name of that? Haifa Street in Baghdad?
Dude, I just can't, it's unbelievable to me the way this guy backpedals and rationalizes right to their faces.
But, he's backpedaling and rationalizing because he really's got nothing for them. That's why he's backpedaling and rationalizing. He cannot guarantee that they're going to be driving around in safer vehicles than they now are driving in. There are still some Humvees in Iraq that are not fully and properly armored. You hear the guy talking about having to pick up ballistic glass to armor their own vehicles. Rumsfeld isn't prepared to promise these people that it will change. What he told reporters afterwards was, we're going to have someone sit down with this guy and talk with him, and if he knows something that we don't know, he'll share it with
us. These guys are such lying bastards, these neocon death cult bastards. I can't believe that's the spin he's going to put on this. This is a president that ran on defense, that ran on military readiness. This is a guy that just the other day, in his silly little specially designed waistcoat with his neocon death cult patch on one side and the American flag on the other side in his little Mussolini jacket. The time of war is a time of sacrifice, especially for our military families. Well, maybe they wouldn't have to sacrifice so much if you put them in cars that didn't get blown up, if you did, put them in something other than Hyundai Hummers.
This is a guy who joined the National Guard just last year. He had been in the Air Force prior to that, I think, starting in 1994. And I'm talking now about Specialist Wilson. This is a guy who was gung-ho. I mean, this is not an anti-war guy. This is not a guy who's prepared to say, I want to get out.
Yeah.
The guy wants to do his job properly. And what he's saying to Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld knows this already.
And not get killed unnecessarily.
Yeah, exactly. But Rumsfeld knows.
Of course, we've known for a long time.
They've been sucking wind like this for since they invaded the country, for God's sake. They know.
Of course they know. This Humvee issue has been around a long time. The flak jackets, remember the flak jackets from police departments being sent over? People's parents and wives, the military's parents and wives were sending over night vision goggles and other things that they might have need. And then the Humvee thing really came to head when a platoon were not willing to take that fuel up into the north.
They wouldn't take it up into the north. This is the window into Donald Rumsfeld's soul right here. This is a quote from Rumsfeld after he talked.
It's not much of a view, is it?
No, kind of shallow.
Yeah.
There's no way I can prove it, but I am told the Army is breaking its neck to see that there is not discrimination of that kind. Now, what the discrimination he's talking about is an allegation that he heard during the same conversation, that regular Army troops are better equipped than the National Guard and Reserves.
Hmm.
In other words, the regular active duty Army people are getting priority for the best equipment that's being used in Iraq.
Hmm.
Now, with 40% of the people over there, National Guard and Reserves, That's a significant minority that feels it's being underarmed. And what's the best he can say? There's no way I can prove it, but I am told the Army is breaking its neck to see that there is not discrimination of that kind.
That's ridiculous, because these National Guards and Reserve guys are the guys that, you know, sign up because, you know, if they have to go, they'll go. But they're not the guys that are, the, you know, sort of hanging out.
Guys sign up for the National Guard because they figure they might pick up a skill that they can use
right.
later on in life. Many of them do feel, that they have an obligation to serve their country. But none of them figured they were going to end up going down Haifa Street in a Humvee with no bottom.
For years.
Yeah.
For months on end.
Yeah.
And the thing is there any way that, you know, we can assume that maybe these guys are being used for fodder on some level, in the sense that if they're not properly equipped, that they're not a priority, and that they're just, protecting the regular Army and just letting these guys sort of flounder without the proper equipment because they don't care about them as much?
This is, to me, yeah, I think it shows a gross lack of respect.
Yes.
You know, for the contribution of those troops.
And that's weird, because this is the branch of the military that George Bush didn't show up to.
Yeah, exactly. Texas Air National Guard. I wonder how well equipped they are.
But he had the uniform. He had the hat, apparently. There are pictures.
Yeah.
But he didn't have a specially made one like he does now.
Benito by Tommy Hilfiger.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this is a guy who is the quintessential toy soldier. And unfortunately, we got four more years of a defense secretary that isn't much better.
But the way this guy rationalizes and displaces blame and acts like he doesn't know what's going on is ridiculous. This is a guy that's been fighting hard to keep his $40 billion, to keep his, you know, his intelligence system within the military. This is a guy that's supposed to be on top. He's got an intelligence agency right within his own military. And, like, he doesn't know what's going on with all this stuff, that he doesn't get reports on this daily as to whether or not they're equipped and what they need. It's ridiculous.
Not now. I'm playing politics. That's what he's been doing. He's been making sure that, as you point out, that money that's supposedly now going to be overseen by this new intel director does not impact him. He controls 80% of it now. He doesn't want to control any less than 80% of it later.
His intelligence isn't good enough to let him know that they don't have the proper equipment they need. And there's also, we got a little sort of like, there's a little CIA cover-up going on.
Yeah.
There's a piece here that we'll share with you in a second that really supports, you know, everything we've been saying here, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Ray!
Is it
okay,
him?
Okay, man. Yeah, he just walked in.
He just slid it under the door.
Yeah, slid it under the door. We'll get the presidential palm pilot. And, of course, the liberal agenda is coming up as we roll on here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Moments like this, Riley. 34 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. That's Mark Riley. I'm Mark Maron.
Yes.
Where I realize that, you know, we really are honoring who we are on this network and what this network means, that we are a morning show. And we, you know, as a counter to every other morning show in the world, who's probably trying to find the most filthiest, dirtiest, raciest gossip or porn star or whatever, we are here, all of us, on the Barbara's Bakery website
that's
looking
right.
at their cereal products.
That's right. NoHun.com for us.
Can you believe that? You're seeing, like, I'm going to get Vivica some of these puffins, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, it's got oat bread, yellow cornmeal. I'm like, what the hell is this? What is this?
People trying to make a better world.
All right. Here we go. We got Ramon came in wearing that same jacket the president's was. Now,
yeah.
I didn't know those were available, but they're smarter looking than I thought, and maybe I'll get one.
Well, you know, try fat form.
You can't get the one especially made for the Fuhrer, but you can get the other one.
Yeah.
Here we go. Rumsfeld's Palm Pilot for today. Here's Rumsfeld's schedule. 0600, wake up shouting every snappy comeback I should have said to those whiny, ungrateful soldiers in Kuwait. Nobody talks to the man fifth in line for the presidency that way. 0630, dig through Iraqi landfills for scrap metal to use as vehicle armor. Show those spoiled punks how a real man scavenges for compromised ballistic glass. 1-800-1800-0800. Ignore complaints that the regular Army is given priority over National Guard troops. Note, intra-squad rivalry is healthy. Toughens them up. They need it. 1230. Have everyone in the 100-foot radius drop and give me 20, because I said so. 1330. Do you say it 0-13-30 or
no, 1330.
Looking to renaming Stop Loss Program the Start Win Program. 1800 hours. Buy more Humvees. Tell dealer we do not need our rides pimped. All right. No pimping the rides.
Oh, it's all about the framing, isn't it?
Yeah. Man, we talked to George Lakoff for like, I think, what was it, 4 hours yesterday?
Yeah, it was a while.
We did a post tape with George Lakoff. I don't know when we're going to run it, but we will. So, yeah, sit on the edge of your seats for that. We've got to parse it to figure out how to tighten it up a little bit. It was a very informative conversation, but the professor, as professors will, was teaching us.
Yes.
You know, and
it wordy was, is what you're looking for.
Well, he framed it like a professor would frame it.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was you know, I learned some things.
We were his recalcitrant students.
Yeah, but the one thing I did learn, though, which was interesting, is that in reframing an issue, which is all the rage right now in Democratic and progressive circles, that, you know, you really, when you're trying to change somebody's mind, or it's not just repetition of a frame. That what Lakoff was saying yesterday was that, you know, you have to put a story behind it, and it has to make sense to that person, because there are these two dominant models of how people behave, and these are almost genetic. That was the interesting thing that I took from what he was saying, is that, yeah, you know, when somebody believes a certain thing, it's not some, you know, decision they made, it's ingrained in their being, it's their core value system that's based on the language they were taught that could have been going on for generations.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah,
if you repeat something without having a story, it just becomes an empty vessel. You know, the idea of framing really is, you know, going to the core of the issue and of the value and making a story out of it, so that whatever you say, you know, falls into a particular framework. And
yeah,
and the only way you're going to, you know, change people's minds is that if the story is effective enough to counter the story they have and make them judge it against it. It was pretty interesting,
yeah,
stuff.
There has to be some comparison. There has to be an opening of a different side of a person.
Yeah, and it was kind of profound to me, because like when in what he's talking about, that there's a nurturing parent,
yeah,
and then there's the strict father model and the nurturing model, nurturing mother model, I guess. And he said that all people have these two leanings in them. You know, what determines which one is more heavy is how you're brought up and what you're,
yeah,
and the values.
The dominant one, and that's the challenge, is to open up that nurturing part in people who have the dominant father part as the part of their persona.
It's sad when you do the nurturing and then right at the end you get the dominant father part or the bully part.
Yeah.
It's like, you're like, oh, what's the matter? You're,
yeah, right,
sad.
That's because you just don't listen.
Yeah, yeah, that happens a lot. People switch up the models right in the middle, you,
yeah,
know what I mean? Just to screw with their kids' heads.
Yep.
But I asked him, I said, this nurturing parent thing, which he says is really at the core of progressive values. I said, and we'll play this at some point, I guess next week maybe. Yeah, I just out and out said, well, what about spoiled kids? You remember I said,
yeah,
that?
You did.
And he goes, oh, that's a different model. That's the permissive parent.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so there's a third one that we got to worry about. And one thing that you're not supposed to have too specific a frame, certainly not partisan framing, is in the CIA. And a senior CIA, I'm pretty good at the segues today, man.
There you go.
Smooth.
There you go. Hitting it.
You want to set this thing up, Riley? You want to push
this
up?
No, man, you hit it.
A senior CIA operative who handled sensitive informants in Iraq asserts that CIA managers asked him to falsify his reporting on weapons of mass destruction and retaliated against him after he refused. This is a cat that is pretty much substantiating everything we said, you know, about, you know, how we were ended up in a war in Iraq, that, and also the way this administration bullies the CIA to get the information they want, not any other information. This guy said it was within the bureaucracy of the CIA to do that.
Oh, yeah. And now, we're not naming him because no one else is naming him. He is still undercover. And he says, and see, this will show you how people will do.
Mm-hmm.
They went after him, he says, because he, or actually, as you mentioned, because he refused to sign off on the weapons of mass destruction thing. But then they started an investigation of allegations that he had sex with a female asset. And they also initiated an investigation into allegations that he stole money that was meant to be used to pay human assets.
Yeah, I don't think I've had sex with an assets before.
Me neither.
Hmm.
But see, what ends up happening is he's thieving. And he's promiscuous.
Well, that's what, yeah, so he stands up against them because they're not supposed to have dogma. They're supposed to be, you know, an information agency, not a partisan information agency. This guy stands up to him and he says, yeah, well, what about that, you know, that
that person you were working with that you had sex with. What about this? So they start to, you know, what they always do.
Yeah.
Make him look like some sort of degenerate.
Exactly. Make him look like a degenerate and make him look like he really doesn't belong in the agency. This is how most agencies, I would hope that that guy Wilson isn't retaliated against.
Joe Wilson?
Yeah. No, not the specialist. Question Rumsfeld.
Oh, okay.
See, because, you know, when the lights go off, when the cameras go off, when the journalists go someplace else, that's when they wait to get you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's when, and in the CIA, of course, there are never any cameras. There are never any lights. So people figure, well, hey, you know, if the guy speaks out, we'll crack his legs for him. And not only will we deal with him, but we'll make sure that anybody else that's of a mind to say anything or stand up or, God forbid, file a lawsuit won't do so.
But this is like one of those weird framing things in that we can't let this kind of stuff fall through the cracks. These guys have not taken responsibility for anything, this neocon death cult bastards. You know, and when they do stuff like this, you know, this guy stood up. Same with that specialist Joe Wilson. They stood up. And I don't know what they're going to say about that guy. But there are going to be repercussions probably somehow, and we're going to have to see that, like, oh, he had Tourette's syndrome, he's got a problem with outbursts, he's got an attitude problem, whatever they're going to say, however they're going to spin it, is going to be, it can't stop there.
You know what scares me about that? They're going to say to him one morning, here, that's your Humvee over there, take that one.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be properly armed.
So you're saying they're going to do some mafia stuff, huh?
Hey, listen, we're dealing, I think, and I mean, maybe I don't say it as often as you do, but I believe that we're dealing on a certain level with some very evil people here.
No question.
And people who will not think twice. When I heard Dick Cheney once say that he would shoot a plane out of the sky with 300 people on it if he needed to, or that he would have had one of the planes involved in September 11th shot down, that made me realize we're dealing with people for whom some human life is a complete abstraction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think these people have any clue how working people actually lead their lives. Those bakers that you ran into up in Seattle, you think that Rumsfeld knows anything about how they live?
You think he knows anything about that buttery croissant he sticks into his face because he doesn't have to worry about a heart attack anymore because he doesn't have a real heart anymore.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, when we come back, we're going to talk about some other, you know, horrendous oversights in that, you know, first of all, there are homeless vets on the streets already from this war, which is profoundly disturbing. And there's a hearing in Canada about a potential deserter who wants asylum, and there was testimony in that hearing by a guy we had on our show who is Jimmy Massey, and it was one of the most powerful interviews that we ever did about just what some of the troops are doing there and why this guy went AWOL and deserted, and why so many of these guys are losing their marbles a little bit and also ending up on the street. So all that when we come back. It's 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hey, want a t-shirt with me and Riley on it? Go to morningsedition.com to check out our full line of Morning Sedition merchandise.
That brings me back, man. Sometimes we do this lead-in music, and it kicks me. I guess I'm getting to that age where I'm like, wow, and nostalgic. That actually brings me back to Boston, which is where we're going to be this weekend in Somerville at the Someday Cafe on Friday, tomorrow morning.
That's right.
6 to 9, live at the Someday Cafe in Davis Square. Come on down, have a cup of coffee. Jimmy Tingle's going to be hanging out, Barry Crimmins Comics. Barney Frank's dropping by. I think the mayor's coming by.
Yeah.
Huh?
We got a bunch of people.
Ted Leo's going to come jam. What do you think of that?
Now, you know, Somerville was the place in Massachusetts where, after the court allowed the gay marriages, Somerville was the town that invited people from out of state, gays from out of state, to come get married there.
The mayor we're going to be talking to.
Yeah.
Actually, his name is Curtatone. Is that how you pronounce it?
You asking me? What is
Joe Curtatone.
Yeah, that's
Curtatone.
Yeah.
But, you know, the weird thing about AC/DC, me and my buddy Cliff, who I called Sniff for obvious reasons, we used to do this thing back when, before I moved in Boston, I was out in Milton, Massachusetts. We'd get in my car and we'd do this thing called the AC/DC Cruise, where we put in a tape of all AC/DC. We'd buy a big old, 40s of beer.
Oh.
And what
we
do is we just drive till we finished a beer and jammed on AC/DC until we finished a beer, and then we drive back. We'd drive around till there's no more beer. Now, I'm not encouraging kids to do that. It's the wrong thing to do if you can't get away with it. But, I did do it in my past. I will admit that's a little confession I have. I did drive and drink and listen to AC/DC and smoke cigarettes and play air guitar and air drums at the same time while operating a vehicle.
You know,
sometimes my buddy Sniff had to take the wheel just so I could solo.
I have friends who've done similar things, but for longer periods of time. They would go, like, on the road for 3 or 4 days. They would drive from New York to Buffalo or something by some backwoods road.
You gotta have a lot of the, you're going to have a lot of that artist material to get to have it be officially like the AC/DC group.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was that they lived on steak and beer for the entire 3 days.
I've done those things. We just drive all night. Oh, yeah, drive 22 hours straight. One time I drove all the way from Wyoming to San Francisco.
Wow.
That was a good one, man.
On Dick Cheney?
Yeah, I dropped by Cheney's house, you know, just to spray paint something on his mailbox, and I moved on down. Here we go. U.S. veterans from the war in Iraq are beginning to show up at homeless shelters around the country, and advocates fear they are the leading edge of a new generation of homeless vets not seen since the Vietnam era, which is no small thing, because nearly 300,000 veterans are homeless on any given night. All right, and almost half of those served during the Vietnam War. And that is mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. And, you know, there were a couple of instances here in New York where a woman who had just gotten back from Iraq, who I believe even had kids, was living in Brooklyn, got into a problem and ended up homeless. And I think they, you know, once there were published reports about it in the paper, she, you know, there were some folks that hooked her up, so she's probably now living in housing. But for a lot of people, you know, you don't come back to the same situation that you left. You're gone for now. It could be as long as 18 months, almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And you come back, you don't know what you're coming back to in all cases.
Well, yeah, sometimes you don't know your children that well. Your wife is, you know, sort of like emotionally detached a bit sometimes. I mean, I'm not even at war, and I spend a lot of time with my wife, and just distance can have a tremendous impact. And that's not even talking about what you saw and what you went through over there and how that changed you, which is, you know, has a lot to do with why some of these guys have gotten very fragile. I mean, you go through enough stuff like the stuff we're going to hear about from Massey.
Yeah.
You know, you hear about that kind of stuff, certainly in Vietnam. Of course, it's going to blow your mind out.
Oh, well, yeah, and it's going to stay with you for a long time. Remember, the Vietnam War ended almost 30 years ago, and for many of these people, they have not been right since now. In previous years and in previous wars, Mark Maron, the place where folks went to get that kind of help was the VA.
Yeah.
Okay? The VA would help with housing. The VA would, and I mean, remember, too, that the VA in many instances provided a much higher level of benefits than they do now.
Mm-hmm.
And that gradual reduction in benefits has meant that a lot of these soldiers are coming home and they're more or less left on their own, left to their own devices.
Yeah, this guy said here that, you know, when he came back, this is Petty Officer Luis Arreño, said that, you know, they came out of the, he was slightly injured on his hand.
Yeah.
And he, quote, it was more of a rush. They put us in a warehouse for a while. They treated us like cattle. All right, and then, you know, they go to these VA hospitals, which apparently have improved a bit as far as, you know, outpatient programs and mental health programs. But it's still very difficult for these guys to get the attention they need because a lot of them come back with substance abuse problems, with, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, with continuing psychological trauma that doesn't just go away no matter what the Bush administration says, that they should just, you know, pull it together. And this whole idea that has come up through Republican ideology from Reagan, that homeless people are by and large just people that can't get their heads together.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous because the repercussions of fighting a war or being in situations where you see the worst of humankind at work, how is that not going to be, you know, completely, you know, devastating? How are you not going to be emotionally and mentally scarred from that? And just pulling, you know, just coming back from that.
Well, and see, the problem with the VA hospitals has not always been just the quality of care. It's also been the backlog.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, some of these, and we've talked to a few soldiers on the phone, Mark, returning vets, who say they've had to wait for extraordinary periods of time to get some kind of help from the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when it comes to VA hospitals. And granted, they can't see everybody all at once. But remember, too, that there have been closures of VA hospitals. Even right here in New York City,
right,
they attempted to close a VA hospital. There, you know, people have to understand that if you're going to ask people to make this kind of sacrifice, you've got to sacrifice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing is here it says data from the Department of Veterans Affairs shows that it's, as of last July, nearly 28,000 veterans from Iraq sought health care from the VA. One out of every five was diagnosed with a mental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's plaguing. And here, like, this is some profound stuff, too, is that 28,000 of these cats these homeless guys are in the Los Angeles area. 27,000 homeless veterans. And it's got the largest population
largest
in the
largest in the country. Well, think about it, Mark. 300,000 homeless vets. That's almost the population of Boston.
Well, apparently around one-fourth of all homeless Americans are veterans. All right, and more than 75% of them have some sort of mental or substance abuse problem, often post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is according to that Homeless Veterans Association. Well, you know, it's a horrendous problem. And, you know, there's a lot of myths around, you know, how these people are treated. You know, I mean, this administration, you know, pays a lot of lip service to things, you know.
That's
like,
all it is.
Like, right, you know, on the January 17, 2003, this is a quote from President Bush, "Seeing the care that these troops get is comforting for me and Laura. We should and must provide the best care for anybody who is willing to put their life in harm's way," end quote. And this is like the same day. The president made these comments on the same day that his administration announced it was cutting off access to its health care system for approximately 164,000 veterans. The administration also is pushing a cut of $1.5 billion in military housing and medical facility fundings, despite the fact that UPI reports hundreds of sick and wounded U.S. soldiers, including many who served in the Iraq War, are languishing in hot cement barracks here while they wait, sometimes for months, to see doctors.
Yep, that's the nut of the problem.
It's unbelievable.
You know, at a point, we have to look out for those who we ask to defend us. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, well, I mean, this whole thing about this deserter who was here having this hearing in Canada, the guy, Jimmy Massey, that's his name, who we talked to a few months ago, is up there to defend this guy's case. To say that, you know, to support his case.
Yeah, he's seeking asylum.
The other guy is, Heisman.
Jeremy Heisman.
It's not clear to me that Massey is. I don't think that's what it says, but Massey is up there to talk about what he saw. And, you know, when we come back, we'll play some of that interview because it blew our minds.
Absolutely.
I certainly remember that. That, of course, is the Liberal Agenda from the Streisand compound. Here we go. Write these down. Use a fire hose. One, use a fire hose to flood Santa's Village at the mall and shout, "The real North Pole is melting from the effects of greenhouse gases." Two, try to wring the last drops of irony out of headlines that juxtapose George W. Bush with intelligence reform. Three, point out the subtle sexism in the fact that there are 12 lords a-leaping, but only 11 ladies dancing. Four, liberate your town's Christmas tree, leaving behind a sign that says, "Tinsel equals slavery."
Oh, God.
Five, phrase of the day. You know those Christmas toys are all made with underpaid elf labor, man. Wake up, people. It's coming down. So when we come back, we're going to hear Jimmy Massey.
We're going to hear Jimmy Massey. We're also going to be talking with Mayor Joe Curtatone of Somerville, Massachusetts.
Right on.
And the Dream Diary here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron, you're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, narrow-minded progressives, and of course, open-minded people as well. Regular folks, good morning to you. People who secretly sit home and seethe and hate. How are you? Are you hating? Are you up early to hate? My dad gets up early to hate.
Does it feel good?
I don't know. He actually gets up early, like... Anyways, moving on. We're going to be in Somerville tomorrow morning. Huh?
Somerville, Mass.
That's right. At the Someday Cafe in Davis Square, our guests will include Barney Frank, Jimmy Tingle, Ted Leo, Barry Crimmins. You don't have to have a ticket. Just come by. We'll give you a T-shirt. We'll give you a keychain. We'll let you hang out, have a cup of coffee while supplies last, Mark Riley.
Thank you.
I can't, you know, hopefully somebody will remember to bring the swag.
Yeah. Who's the swagmeister?
Yeah, I don't know who that would be. It's one of them. one of those people who carry stuff, Sherpas? Is that what they're called?
Sherpas.
Sherpas? Yeah. Yeah. All right, here we go. Let's get back to the heavy, dire stuff that we were talking about before, about new homeless vets and about this case in Toronto where a former United States Marine is trying to get asylum.
Yeah.
Jeremy Heinzman. He's a former staff sergeant. I think he's just a regular Marine. But Jimmy Massey, who is a former staff sergeant, is testifying on his behalf up there.
Now, it's very rare that the Canadians will grant this kind of asylum. It's not unprecedented, but it is not done every day. Usually what happens when people who leave the military, particularly people who are perceived as deserters, wind up in Canada, the Canadians simply quietly ship them back to the U.S.
Right.
And then they face court-martials.
Well, I thought, there's this mythology from the 60s that, everybody can just go to Canada and hang out and have free drugs and free health care and be a deserter if they want. That's not true.
Well,
huh?
No. If you want to evade the draft, you can get away with going to Canada.
Okay.
That's no harm, no foul.
Okay.
But if you're in already and you desert, that was kind of a different sort of thing.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So it's on a sort of dark note and a very realistic note is that, when we talked to Jimmy Massey back in May, I think we talked to him.
May 26th, I believe.
He was basically coming forward with some of the stuff that was going on in Iraq that was not, generally in the news in any way. And I remember being a very powerful, moment. Now, how this is going to, help this guy who wants asylum in Canada, how's that going to work? Is he basically saying that by testifying this guy, he said that, it's completely understandable why he would want to leave and why he would not want to finish up his duty? Is that why he's testifying, Mark Riley?
Yeah, it is. And he's saying, in essence, look, I believe this war to be immoral and illegal, and that's the reason why I left.
Well, certainly
and,
that.
Yeah, and the fact that, there were people murdering unarmed Iraqis, allegedly, was reason enough. Now, remember now, these folks were supposedly eyewitnesses to these events. It's not like they read about them in the paper or something.
Yeah.
So their thing is, this is an unjust, illegal war. The illegal part is the important part, because that's where the Canadians might have a little wiggle room to let him stay.
Well, let's hear that. This is me, Mark Maron, talking to Jimmy Massey, former Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey, back in May. And what was the event that was sort of where you had this, this completely change of heart, this change of mind about what you're doing there?
Right. Well, I was just outside, on the outskirts of Baghdad. There was an incident that was near the Baghdad stadium, and we had opened fire on a vehicle that came into our red zone, which was our zone that we opened fired. After we had opened fired on this vehicle, we went over and pulled the occupants out. Three of them were fatally wounded. They were dying. We called the medics. They came over and started doing reviving resuscitation on them. However, one of the Iraqis that was in the car, he was unscathed. And he walked up to me. He knew that obviously I was in some sort of command. He walked up to me and he said, "Why did you shoot us? Why did you kill my brother?"
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do anything to you. We're not terrorists." That was the turning point.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And in this other report here, in this Lance Corporal James Claven Brown Jr. is in a shelter, as we were talking about before the break. This homeless vet situation has very similar stories. He acknowledges the mental stresses of war, and he talks about, quote, "We had a few situations, I guess, people were trying to get out of the country. They would come right at us, and they would not stop. And we had to open fire on them. It was really tough. A lot of soldiers like me had trouble with that. That was the hardest part. Not only were there men, but there were women and children, really little children. There would be babies with arms blown off. It was something hard to live with."
See, this is one of the realities of life in Iraq, that the soldiers there, and they're not totally to blame for all this. You heard Jimmy Massey say the truck drove, or whatever it was, drove into the red zone. Well, the red zone is the area where it's defined by the military as too close,
mm-hmm.
as a situation where they don't know whether this is a suicide bomber or just a group of unarmed people who don't understand the language well enough to know what stop means.
And the civilian casualties are just in the, almost probably close to 100,000, just thousands of people.
Thousands of people.
And we don't get to any numbers on that. And also yesterday I said that it marked the 1,000th soldier dead in combat. And, of course, somebody immediately said, "I thought we passed that landmark a long time ago on the on the email. And no, we didn't pass that landmark. There's been 1,200 plus dead for many different reasons. There's another couple hundred that die of, you know, heart attacks or, you know, car accidents that weren't combat related. Or
a lot of those car accidents, by the way, a lot more than most people realize.
Sure. You know, but, you know, that was yesterday. I mean, this thing is, you know, when we talk to guys like that, like not unlike when we talk to Mick Ware, you know, when the realities of war really come, you know, into our life right here, you know, it's like, it really makes me angry. It makes me sad. You know, it makes me, you know, grateful to not have to be in that. That's
to be put in that situation and to be put in that situation under what are now definably false circumstances, wrong circumstances. We were lied to. Those soldiers were lied to when they were sent there. And again, I don't fault the soldiers per se. Many of them are simply following policy. Or, and I mean, Mark, it's very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand what it must be like to feel like you are a half a step away from death all the time.
Dude, the cortisol from the anxiety and the fear pumping through your brains, it's just kind of like running your soul against a grater.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can't even imagine, you know, how frazzled and it's just horrible. If I get my brain going just in my own apartment over nothing, knowing I'm locked in there, you know, I can freak myself out.
Yeah, and I mean, at a point, the people who put the soldiers in this position have to answer.
So, if you've got anything you want to add to this conversation, if you are a vet, if you've been to Iraq, if you know what we're talking about, if you have something to say about somebody who wants asylum in Canada because they aren't willing to go into a war that they think is wrong, you know, call us up, 866-303-2270. We'll come back with your calls, and also we're going to talk about the future of the Democratic Party. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
Call us at 866-303-2270.
That's 866-303-2270. 6-303-2270. Morning Sedition
on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 20 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. We'll be talking to you guys in a minute. Looks like Mayor Joe Curtatone is on the phone from Somerville as well. Let me do this now, though. Oh, did I cancel my therapy? I did. I canceled it. Here we go. Here's my dream from last night. I'm at the Air America Radio holiday party. Everyone's milling around, drinking, swapping filthy sex stories about Doug Krieger, that kind of thing. I make my way to the buffet table where there's an ice sculpture of Marty Kaplan. Very nice. Gathered around are all my coworkers drinking the punch, so I have some. Hey, not bad. So I see Randy Rhodes, and she says to me, "Well, Mark, it looks like President Bush won the election fair and square. I guess we can just move on from all this recount business." This freaks me out a little. And just then, everyone starts talking at once. And Al Franken says, the veterans really are getting a fair shake from President Bush. I hope I get an invite to his inaugural. And Janine Garofalo says, "Bush is so smart, and he and Laura are a much cooler couple than Spike Jones and Sofia Coppola." And Wayne Gilman says, "You know, Gondi Rice is not a Tom. Not even close." And Liz Winstead says, "Bush has got my mandate." And Rachel Maddow says, "Bush has been so good for the gay community." And Chuck D says, "Yeah, and he really knows his hip-hop. Bush is way blacker than Bill Clinton." I take a drink and find myself saying, "The Iraq war is going great. We really are safer." My head starts spinning. What's happening? Then I connect the dots. The punch. Rove got to the punch. I see Riley, and he's just about to take a big drink. I dive in front of him sideways and knock the cup out of his hand. Just before I blacked out, I managed one word. Tainted. They rushed me to the hospital and pumped my stomach. As I was coming to, a worried nurse loomed over me and said, "Mr. Maron, are you all right? Say something. Say something. The neocon, death cult, crystal fascist zombie brigade." That was a close one. I woke up and my bed was filled with Nilla wafers. Okay, shall we talk to the mayor?
Yes, we should.
Okay, on the phone from Somerville, Massachusetts, Mayor Joe Curtatone. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Hey, Mark and Mark, how's it going today?
Good morning.
Pretty good. So we're coming to your town tomorrow. Is that okay?
That's fine. All right. We'll roll out the red carpet for you. We're going to see you tomorrow, 6 to 9 at the Someday Cafe, right?
That's right. Are you going to be there?
I'm going to come by and hop in Davis Square. You can't beat it.
All right. When I lived there, it wasn't so hopping. That was back in the 80s, though. Now it's hopping, huh?
It's hopping. Matter of fact, they call it the Palace of Somerville.
Not sure. I haven't been there in a long time, apparently. I'm looking forward to going to Redbones, maybe to Dunkin' Donuts Coffee. Is that still there?
The Dunkin' Donuts is there.
And the Redbones?
That'll never go.
You ever eat at the Redbones?
Don't have our standards, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Got to keep a little of the old school with the new school.
Exactly.
So, you know, what sites should we go to while we're in Somerville?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, when's the last time you were here in the 80s?
Yeah, I was here in the late 80s, yeah.
I'll tell you, everything's changed, all the squares, you know, not too far up in Teal Square.
Yeah.
Whether it's Teal Square, Ball Square, any of the squares. It's really a regional restaurant draw right now. It's fantastic. Strong, dynamic, creative community, a lot of artists, second per capita in artists only to New York City, so there's a lot of things happening.
Really? That's amazing, man.
When I saw that, I said, whoa. Now, Mayor, let me ask you about the town itself, the city of Somerville itself. I understand it's one of the most densely populated cities in New England?
Yeah, it is number one in New England, one of the most in the country. At one point, the world, it was number one in the world.
Wow.
We're about, you know, officially on the books around 80,000 at 4.1 square miles. I'll tell you, the reality is we're closer to 100,000 in the city, but even officially we're still number one in New England.
And you got room for us?
Oh, come on down. We got a few apartments there, guys. You can set up shop right now.
I used to live in an attic in a house over there on Cottage Ave.
Yeah, hey, Mark, I grew up in an attic in our house.
Hey, so let's talk politics for a minute. You are part of the new wave of Democrats coming into the world. What does, you know, Howard Dean spoke yesterday, and he had a pretty profound message for, you know, to Democrats to stick by their core values and not move towards the center. You know, how do you feel about the momentum of a lot of mayors and governors coming into their office in red states? Why is that happening on a local level and not on the broader level?
You know, I think, you know, Howard Dean, that's a good point about Howard Dean. And I think, you know, I remember that the night of the election.
Yeah.
And myself and a lot of other mayors, we tried to help out Senator Kerry. We campaigned in Pennsylvania and other states such as New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't even disappointed. I was really pissed off.
Yeah.
I thought the Democrats blew a great opportunity.
How so?
And I think it's because we were too afraid. You know, we shied away from debating them. We didn't want to get into this moral debate with them.
Yeah.
We have plenty in our basic core values to take them on in that debate, take them head on.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about, you know, I remember the following week I was at, a couple weeks later, I heard Senator Hillary Clinton speak at Tufts University.
Uh-huh.
And, one thing she brought up, you know, because someone asked a question about the movement towards the moral values
playing
a role in the election.
Right.
And she said, geez, you know, I read the Bible, and the last time I read scripture, it talked about taking care of the poor.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about not having jobs in this country and the moral values of that. Let's talk about, the moral values of this war we're fighting in the Middle East. I mean, we can take it on our basic core values. On the lack of a domestic agenda and what that means in it as far as moral values.
Yeah, and you were one of the guys that said, you know, come on down and get married, doesn't matter who you are, right?
Exactly. Treat everybody fairly. I mean, is this administration taking a position of treating everybody in the same level of fairness? I don't think so.
Oh, no.
Do they have a strong domestic agenda to make sure people have jobs and health care?
No.
I don't think so. Where's the morality in that? Where's the compassion in that? I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't either.
Mr. Mayor, I wanted to ask you about a semi-local issue. You know, we were talking yesterday with one of our editorial producers who actually went to Tufts about the Big Dig, and he thinks it's the most wonderful thing in the world, and I wondered how it affects Somerville. Everybody talks about it in terms of Boston. How is it affecting your city?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I do a lot of traveling, and I either meet people who live in Somerville or drove through it, one of the two.
Yeah.
And I think that's still the case today. It's a fantastic city. The Big Dig, I think the Big Dig's been a good thing. You know, it's sort of controlled chaos. At least the traffic is moving, even though it's dense. But we have a lot of spill-off and effect on our community. Just, I don't know, Mark, if you remember McGrath Highway?
Sure.
Just McGrath Highway, on a normal day, we have well over 60,000 cars per day on that one corridor. We have more forms of transportation infrastructure that come to our community, but we don't get a lot of service in our city. So the Big Dig, though it may have helped, you know, relief congestion on the central artery, still creates a lot of spill-off in our city.
Wasn't there a Leachmere out there?
Yeah, Leachmere now has been shut down. They're moving it over to the and then moving over to the other side of the
Yeah, I'm going to start talking with your accent if I keep talking.
But anyway, the bottom line is, you know, the cities like Selma, we it used to be, you know, when you talk about the dynamics of the community, it's really a community that's been shaped by many different mistakes and positive things over the years. We used to have 17 real stops in the small city, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Now we got one, which is Davis Square, where you're going tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're actually fighting right now with the state to try to get the Green Line extension, which is Leachmere, through our community, because we get 8 rail lines that go through our city and only one stop.
I know. We're going to have to take that. I think we're going to have to take the train from South Station. We go right over there, right?
Yeah, come right over.
Okay, Mayor, we're going to see you tomorrow, and it's great talking. We're looking forward to talking to you tomorrow in your city.
Come on now. We can't wait to see you.
Okay, right. Thanks a lot. That was Mayor Joe Cordatone. And now we're going to take some of your calls at 866. What do you mean, John Larson, talking in my head? What about in the next? We got David K. Johnson coming up. Well, let's take one here. How about Kathy in Miami? Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good morning.
Okay.
Great show.
Thank you.
I, you know, the veterans, that whole issue, I worked at a VA hospital for several years, and it was post-Vietnam era, but it's very, very sad, and I am so sick and tired of the armchair warriors who have high testosterone, who watch one too many John Wayne movies.
Yes.
Thinking that's what war is about.
Yeah, it's just not. It's not the case. Yeah, thank you very much, Kathy. We ran out of time a little bit there, but thank you for your call. I'm sorry we weren't able to talk to you a little longer. We've got a guest coming up. We'll have more calls later in the show, but she's absolutely right.
No, she is absolutely right. David K. Johnson joins us next. He's financial reporter for the New York Times. We're going to talk about the covert, well, actually, his book is called Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else.
Social Security, when
Social Security,
about.
When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are is right. Good morning. The Bible's book of Revelations portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milpington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Smileyburg, Kansas. Your grace.
Heed my clarion call, ye Carthaginian baby eaters. Behold my beseechments, thou gluttonizing sucklers at the teats of Dom DeLuise's man breasts. Get a clue, ye kibble-eating retromingents. Yeah, you heard me. It means you piss backwards. Took me a long time to find that one. The end times are nigh, earth dwellers, so pack up your crap. Leave a tuna fish sandwich for Santa and stop your crying. Last abdominal, I told you about a Texas university that gave a master's degree in business administration to a cat. The week before that, I told you about a man who smeared 14 jars of Vaseline all over a New York hotel room. And the week before that, I should have told you, if you don't want to leave fingerprints, use Astroglide.
Oh, man.
It's water-based, and you don't have to worry about embarrassing doorknob rash. But now on to your fate. For God's holy rapture is a-coming down the street. Oh, please let it be for me. That's right. God's holy rapture is a-coming down the street. I think you know what it can be. I got some salmon from Seattle last September. And I expect a new rocking chair. I hope I get my raisins from... Damn thee, Satan! My powers are strong to have me break into the lyrics of a gay musical. Yet another sign, midnight approaches. For according to a certain Dr. Aubrey de Grey of Cambridge University, or as he's known here at Rapture Watch, Dr. Anton LaVey of Insane Bridge University, medicine will soon be able to make people live up to 1,000 years. Heresy. Apostical. For only by living obediently under the reign of King Jesus, you know, sitting around waiting to be sucked up to heaven while corporate America kills the rest of us, can we live to be 1,000 years old? Not by receiving vaccinations or other marks of the beast. For it was prophesied in Revelation 76, trombones led a big parade. And I quote, and those which have not worshipped the beast, neither his image, nor had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, they shall live and reign with Christ 1,000 years. Shipoopy, shipoopy, the girls is hard to get. End quote. Now listen closely, because I'm about to teach you something. Dr. LaVey formulated his opinions while conducting work in a project designed to prevent and cure aging called Strategies for Engineered Negligible Sentience, or SINS. Is it mere coincidence that when you replace the letter E with I, the acronym SINS turns into SINS? Okay, how about this? Don't replace the letter E, but add the letters I-M-I-L-L-A. It spells Sensimea. Or how about this? Take all the letters of the acronym SINS and just get rid of them. Forget about them. Then replace them with the words devil baby. Is it just mere coincidence when you do that? That SINS spells out the words devil baby?
No.
What's everybody looking at? I drink because I want to, not because I need to. So mind your own business. In the meantime, keep on fornicating, fornicators, and we'll keep the light on for you. In hell.
Wow. Yeah, Cardinal, yeah, you all right?
Yeah, Dick Clark had a stroke.
Oh. Yeah. Well, you know, it's always nice to have you down, even if you're upset.
I'm upset about a lot of things. What's your name again?
Mark Maron, it's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
Right. I know Mark Riley.
Oh, man.
Thanks, Cardinal.
All right, thanks a lot.
Have a good day, man.
Whatever.
Yeah. All right. Right now, shifting gears.
Yeah, right.
But we're going to get into something equally as demonic. Finance reporter for the New York Times, his book Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, was just named the Investigative Book of the Year by Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. David K. Johnson is with us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mark.
That's
good morning.
Mark, good morning to you, too.
So we got to get right into this Social Security thing, because I understand none of it. That's not true. I understand some of it. The privatization is not really even a privatization, is it?
Well, it's a big new government program proposed by Republicans who say they want smaller government.
Okay, and how does that work?
Well, the president, who likes to say, you know, it's your money and he wants you to keep more of it,
mm-hmm.
is proposing to take up to 4 points of your Social Security investment, up to $1,000 a year, and have that put into the stock market.
So gamble with it, basically.
Well, I think you can invest with it, particularly over a long period of time. I think it's gambling, but... here's a simple question. Why do we need a big new government program that will generate all these fees for brokers on Wall Street? Why not simply say, here's your 4 percentage points. You can keep an extra $1,000 a year from Social Security, and you can save it for the future, and you can invest it if you want. You can go spend it, and if you do, well, when you're old and you're hungry and out on the street, we don't care.
Right.
Don't call the government.
Be responsible. Take self. I mean, it strikes me as just incredible to see a program vastly bigger than, given the changes in the economy over time, than FDR put forward, being put forth by Republicans who say they want to shrink the government.
Well, that's sort of a lie. They only want to shrink it when it's not making them money.
Yeah, right.
Well, one of the things about this is, you should keep in mind, is the investment world out there will yeah. tell you that until an account has $5,000 in it, they don't make any money on it.
Right.
So the first 5 years, you put $1,000 in it, and you won't be able to do that unless you're making around $50,000 a year. They're not going to make any money on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to eat into the value of your fund, or as taxpayers, you're going to have to pay for it. And then on top of all of this, they want to fund this the program by borrowing another trillion or $2 trillion.
From who?
Well, from ourselves.
That's wow. it? You just say, okay, I'm going to borrow this from me?
Hey, Mary, you got any money?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. You need to get out your credit card so you can fund your 401k plan.
How does that work, that you borrow money from yourself? Can you explain that, I mean, as a country?
Well, we're doing it right now with Social Security. I mean, one of the things going on with Social Security is the government is collecting more money in Social Security benefits than it's paying out. More in taxes than it's paying out in benefits.
That was Greenspan did that, right?
That's right. It's about $144 billion this year.
That's the trust?
That's the trust.
Right.
Now, that $144 billion is being used to finance lower taxes for the super rich. So if you make less than $90,000 a year,
yeah.
the government's taking more than it needs out of your check, and it's running it through the trust fund so that those people who make millions of dollars a year can pay lower taxes.
That's what
you're lending to them, and your interest rate is zero.
Why hasn't anyone proposed raising the cap? Right now, what is it? It's somewhere between $81,000 and $90,000.
About $90,000.
$90,000. All right. 90,000 Above that, nothing comes in
anyway.
Because
the benefits are capped. I mean, you could raise the cap, but then you'd have the argument that, okay, we'll raise the cap to $5 million a year, but then Jack Welch and people like him are going to want a $4 million a year Social Security check.
I mean, aside from all the rest of the money that they've got salted away.
That's right. I mean, one of the fundamental issues to think about here is that the Republicans have an agenda. The Democrats don't have a clue. I mean, the president has proposed this plan, and the Democrat, which is fundamentally designed to break down the intergenerational nature of Social Security, and we have things all throughout our society to do that. You and I, Mark, pay taxes so that children born today can have an education that will benefit our society in the future.
Absolutely. I do, too.
Yeah, you too. Okay.
Sort of.
A lot of people listening. And Social Security is the same thing. Today's workers finance a program for people who worked before and made our lives possible.
Right.
There are lots of intergenerational transfers. But
what?
This...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean
no.
that. But what about the myth of the money running out? I mean, is that...
The money's not going to run out.
Right,
exactly. Now, money may run out in Medicare. That's the one you should worry about.
Right.
But in the case of Social Security, first of all, the trust fund has enough money, even the administration acknowledges, until I think it's 2042, and I'm unlikely to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, some minor changes would provide a sufficient amount of money in the program, and the projection that it will be out of money at that point is based on very pessimistic assumptions about economic growth.
Okay.
Now, I heard something about this. They are talking about a 1% growth in the gross national product or something?
Well, Social Security's budgets are estimated on lower growth rates than the president says his tax cuts will produce.
Will produce, yeah.
So why don't we use the same standard for all of these things?
Yeah, it's 1% that they're estimating, and 3% is what the administration says the cuts are going to produce, right?
That's exactly correct.
Well, they use those numbers to sell their lies. They need to sell the thing, so they're going to, you know, the growth is going to be negligible as
well.
Bill
Clinton said at the Democratic National Convention something. Mark, I disagree about lies. He said they believe this stuff,
yeah.
And they do. I mean, the people who are promoting this, in fact, honestly believe what they're doing, and I think we need to appreciate that that's the case. And then you can judge on its merits, well, is this a good idea or a bad idea? So the first question you ought to ask yourself is, do I want to put another trillion or $2 trillion on the government's credit card, which I'm ultimately responsible for as a taxpayer, so that young people can invest in the stock market?
Yeah.
Does that sound like a smart idea to me? If it does, then you ought to go for it.
All right, well, I'm going to have to think about it over this break. We're going to be back with David K. Johnson. We're going to talk about the Treasury Secretary. Why do you think he's staying, and what was the flap about there? And other things. I want to talk about where America... I want to talk about China lending us money and how that works.
Yeah.
It's 44 past the hour. We'll be back on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. It's not Marxism. It's Marxism. Mark Maron and Mark Riley every morning on Air America Radio.
That's the hour. Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition.
Good morning.
On Air America Radio. Good morning to you. Our guest is David K. Johnson. He's a financial reporter for the New York Times. His book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, was just named the Investigative Book of the Year by Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. We were talking about Social Security. I want to move the conversation to, I hear, you know, I am an economic stupid. I can't wrap my brain around it. I got to sit down. I need to be taught. Do you teach a class by any chance?
I have. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I need to know more of the basics because it is what makes the world go round. And now I keep hearing about how China owns this country. How is that possible? Can you explain that to me? How much money
sure.
we borrow and why?
Sure. We have a trade deficit with China, which means that we are sending dollars to China and they are sending us goods here.
Right. Walmart gets all of that stuff.
That's
right.
And
DVDs.
And there is an enormous trade deficit that's occurring. And when you look at the total U.S. situation in 1990, we had a trade surplus that we'd built up over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're the biggest creditor nation in the world. And Warren Buffett, certainly a man who knows a lot about money, says we are basically selling 2% of America per year overseas to finance current consumption.
When did you say that?
Oh, about a year ago.
All right.
So we have a society, we say we want to have a consumer society, we want to have shopping malls, we want Americans to get up there and spend, we want you to buy things, but we don't want to pay the level of wages to sustain that kind of society.
You mean manufacturing here?
Jobs here,
right.
And remember, we have fewer jobs at the moment than we had at the beginning of the administration when all the tax cuts were supposed to produce new jobs. And because of population growth, we should really have 6 to 8 million more jobs.
Right.
And at some point, you know, it's no longer the previous administration's fault.
Yes.
I don't know when that point is, but there's such a point. But we have not seen the promised explosion of jobs in the U.S. We've seen them in China. And there are some academic studies coming out now based on the Chinese statistics of the Chinese government, which are probably puffed up,
yeah,
that show there is no net gain from all these offshoring of jobs to China. That the when a Walmart opens in China, a bunch of little merchants go out of business. So there's a gain to Walmart, a loss to those little merchants. And the net effect is that the capitalist class and the managerial class are taking more than 100% of the gains in China resulting from the U.S., German, French direct investment over there.
Yeah, wow.
Incredible.
So now let me just understand something. Now, if this is a consumer-based society and we have this trade deficit with China and they are making everything and we've put people out of work here because no one wants to put the money into giving them health care or paying them proper wages, eventually what happens to how are these people going to continue buying goods?
Well, what happens is the Chinese are in the same place that the Middle East countries were back in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and they would recycle their money. The Chinese buy U.S. government debt.
Mm-hmm.
They are financing our economy. They send the dollars back here, and they get treasury bonds and notes in return, on which we pay them interest.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that is essentially what's going on, is a transfer from labor in the United States to capital in China. And this year, about 22, 23 cents out of every dollar you pay in income taxes is going to pay interest on the national debt.
Man.
Now, I've got a question for you. It's along the same lines. I don't understand. I mean, there is the euro, I think, is very close to an all-time high against the dollar. Why are the Europeans upset with that?
Well, because as you want to sell things from one place to another, it has costs. So Europeans are coming to the U.S. If you're Disneyland right now, you're happy. People from France and Germany, they're flying over, and they're having a great time because it's cheap to come here.
Yeah.
Americans, however, are not going to be buying as many Volkswagens.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay, because it costs more.
That's right, it costs more. If a dollar is, you know, 2 years ago, a euro cost 90 cents. Now it costs $1.33. I mean, I wish when I was in walking down the street in Europe, then I walked by a bank, it said 5% interest, better than we're paying, and I thought I should go open a bank account. All you have to do is declare it to the IRS, then it's legal, and put the money in there. Boy, if I didn't, I would have made 50% on my savings account between the interest and the change in the value of the dollar to the euro. So there is no, you know, part of what we have to keep in mind is that there is a perpetual search by people for a free lunch. There is no free lunch. If we spend money we don't have, as consumers, we end up with interest that consumes our ability then to spend money on other things. And as a government, then, if we're spending all this money on interest, we're paying increasingly Chinese capitalists interest, then we don't have money for education, healthcare, and those things that perpetuate democracy in America.
Mm-hmm. So George Bush was putting all this lip service into what, an ownership society? Is that was the big catchphrase, ownership? It's really a debt. It's a debt culture.
It's a debt culture, and you know what? There isn't enough wealth in America. And it's interesting, something you often hear Republicans say, there isn't enough wealth in America to make the rich pay all the taxes. Well, there isn't enough wealth in America that if we divide it up all equally, you and I could all live off clipping coupons on our interest.
Right.
The vast majority of people have to work. So
just to service the debt.
That's right. Now, that doesn't mean you don't want to have people have assets. One of the worst troubling things about being poor, and I grew up poor, my dad was 100% disabled veteran, is they don't have any assets. And when something happens, your car breaks down, you can't afford to fix it, so you lose your job.
Nothing to fall back on.
Nothing to fall back on. So we do want to have people have assets. But the ownership society the president's talking about is something quite different. And, you know, keep in mind that the President Bush's fortune derives primarily from a tax increase that was funneled into his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little, you know, contradiction on that sort of view that, you know, you should keep more money in your pocket. People in Arlington, Texas put money into President Bush's pocket, and it's almost his entire fortune.
Wow. So now let me then, can you look into the future a little bit? Give me some ideas as how we bring some of these jobs back. Do you speculate along those lines? I mean, how does manufacturing return home? What needs to happen to make that happen?
Well, if you're running a big U.S. company and you're not firing Americans as fast as you can and moving jobs offshore, you ought to be fired, because that's what the rules are telling you to do. So what you have to do is change the rules. The capital moves across borders with the push of a button.
Mm-hmm.
Labor can't. I mean, even if you guys were offered a job in Bangladesh tomorrow, you're not going to go, because the Bangladeshis are going to want the jobs for Bangladeshis.
Right.
So we need to recognize that. In Wall Street, there's something called arbitrage. You find out a stock is selling at a nickel difference in price between the market, say, in New York and San Francisco. And if you can execute a trade in between for millions of shares, you can make a lot of money.
Right.
Well, there's an enormous arbitrage going on between capital and labor.
Okay.
Because capital moves freely across borders and labor doesn't. So that's why jobs are going short. And we have to sit back and look at the rules. Maybe in the long run, the economic theory that says trade will make us richer is correct. And there are some economists who disagree with this idea, that you need to, there are some who argue you need to protect certain core industries. The problem, as John Maynard Keynes said, is in the long run, we are all dead.
Right.
And we have to live here and now. And politicians need to be thinking about people needing jobs now. And we're short right now about 6 to 8 million jobs from where we should be. Incomes are falling. From 2000 to 2002, that's the latest we have data.
Yeah.
Incomes of people who make $25,000 to $100,000 a year fell 4.5% adjusted for inflation.
Right.
They're down. They're not up.
They're down.
Incredible. He's scaring me.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
He's scaring me.
Is there any hope? Yes or no?
Yeah, I think people have to wake up and take a role in their government and say, we want policies that benefit us.
There you go. That's a good thing to go out on. David K. Johnson, thank you. The book is Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
We're going to come back and hear from Staff Sergeant Massey again.
Jimmy Massey. We're going to hear from him.
Powerful interview.
And we're also going to talk later in the hour to Nan Aaron. She is from the Alliance for Justice here on Air America.
Wash off the blackboard.
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, oversensitive progressives, narrow-minded liberals, open-minded liberals, open-minded people, regular folks, working class heroes. How are you, Mark Riley?
I'm doing all right. Which one of them am I?
I don't know. You know, I just reel things off so people will get offended or not offended or take it too seriously. You know, there's a lot of people just sort of like, hey, did you hear what he said? That's why I don't like this guy.
Ah.
And other people are like, hey, I'm one of them. So, look, we're going to be up in Boston tomorrow at the Someday Cafe in Davis Square in Somerville. Our guests are going to be Barney Frank. That should be fun. Comedian Jimmy Tingle. Musician Ted Leo. It's going to be great. Barry Crimmins. Very funny. Got a book out. And he's a comedian.
And the mayor's coming, right?
The mayor is going to be there. We talked to him earlier. I'm looking forward to talking to him in person.
That accent,
that's
man.
Mayo Joe Curtitone.
Yeah.
One of the true Democrats.
Real Democrat.
As Howard Dean says, not one of these sort of Republican lights, not one of these sort of guys trying to move towards the center and compromise our core values. He's the real deal.
Yeah. You know, I like Dean, actually. I like the fact that he is saying, look, it's time for the Democrats to come home and develop a program that will speak to the American people. I believe that part of the reason why, I guess for want of a better term, liberal/progressive politics, just hasn't resonated with everyone is because it doesn't really reach everyone where they are.
Well, I think also that a lot of people that were proponents of that particular way of thinking, like old school Democrats, a lot of people made a lot of money and then stopped caring about other people.
Yeah, you're right about that.
I just think that really their priorities became selfish and careerist. And a lot of the people that mobilized on a grassroots level, on local politics level, sort of dissipated for some reason.
But, you know, man, I got to ask you. I mean, look at you.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. You take care in what you buy. You don't try. I mean, you have a level of integrity about what you try to consume.
Yes.
You're not, you know, consuming stuff from right-wing yahoos, and I'm talking about now products or whatever. Yeah. I do. For a long time, until I got this job, actually, I used to ride public transportation to work every day because I believe in public transportation.
I still ride public transportation.
Are we the only two people left on planet Earth here?
I don't know. You know, I think a lot of that has to do with the city you're in and also with what you can get and what you can't get. You know, it's an interesting thing that it turns out like a lot of things that people think are good products, they don't know better. I mean, it's not until you go to ChooseTheBlue.com or you go to one of these places where you have to do a certain amount of research just to find out what you're putting in your head, what you're putting in your mouth, what you're putting in, you know, on your house.
I mean, but I was always taught to do that. From the time I was in high school, I was always taught.
Well, sometimes it gets a little tricky because some companies are subsidiaries.
Oh, yeah, subsidiaries and mergers and acquisitions.
Certainly a lot easier now, you know, and we all transgress. What are you going to do? It's the way of the world. I mean, it's very hard unless you want to live off the grid and be naked and just, you know, make your own clothes.
But it's not just that. Yeah. Look, I mean, on a personal level, we both love our wives. I love my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to cede anything to anybody as far as the moral values thing. You know, back in the day, I used to mess up, but that was then.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't understand what's the problem.
In terms of
people being prepared to attack the way I live my life, the way you live your life. You know what I'm saying?
It's a willingness to make sacrifice for the better of the whole good.
The larger good, yeah.
It's a lack of selfishness. It's the idea that you don't just, you know, fight to get your own. You know, it's the idea that, you know, if the whole system is working to help people, that everybody will feel better about themselves.
And the people benefit, tangibly benefit. If you make an investment in seeing to it that a child is properly educated, you benefit from that later on down the road.
Absolutely. There's more ideas that come into the world. There's more, there's more growth in the world. If kids are given the right education, they're given the opportunity to have some vision. I really think that the marginalizing of the educational system, the narrowing of the cultural mind, certainly when people want to change textbooks, you know, to not accommodate, you know, people's human rights to be who they want to be in this world, that I don't know what that agenda ultimately yields. It yields a bunch of, you know, sort of narrow-minded, you know, ideologically repressed people who will put up with whatever crap, you know, the people with the money put them through. It's a very sad state of affairs. And I also think what you were talking about is a lot of people that got nothing, you know, unfortunately think that they're just, you know, 2 days away from having something, whether it's a lottery ticket or whether they work harder or they think that if they put more hours in. But even as we talked to that economist last hour, that's really not the case, and it's a myth.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, you mix that with a little of religious fanaticism, these people think they're going to get theirs in the end. And I don't know how they pulled that trick off over years and years of framing a cultural dialogue, but we've got to reintroduce democratic core values back to the people that affects them most and teach them, and not teach them, I don't want to condescend, but let them know that they will be represented and that this stuff can work for the entire community.
Absolutely.
Society.
Yep, got to expose them to the information. And see the Social Security thing. I really believe, and again, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do believe that at the core of this Bush program is an eventual attack on Social Security itself. There have been people in this society, Mark Maron, who have never been, since the early 1930s when Roosevelt pushed Social Security through, there have been people who have never been comfortable with the idea of a retirement program that most Americans can avail themselves of.
Right.
And they want to see it end, not just change, not just put people in a situation where they're investing. They want to see it die.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, and see, these folks, these are the same people that overreached during the contract with America. The same people who said, well, you can put kids that are in trouble, just put them in orphanages.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Same people.
Well, that's what they want the people to just die. They know that the people, like, you've got 45 million people without health care. You got tons of unemployed people. You've got homeless vets all over the streets now. You've got, you know, a lot of issues where I think these guys, like you said, they don't look at them as human lives. They just look at it as numbers. Like, they can actually say, well, you know what? If they can't adapt, they're going to die. And if they can't adapt, they're going to be so downtrodden that they're not going to have a voice for themselves, and they won't think that anything will ever become of them. Or you get the ones that think that something will. But both of the sides of that, either you get disenfranchised people that are not going to be part of the political process, not going to be voting, they're not going to be even, you know, a functioning member of society, and then you got the other ones that will do what the Republicans tell them to do because they think they're part of it.
Yeah.
And there's an insanity there that baffles me. And as far as public education, getting back full circle, what you were talking about before. I love public transportation.
Yeah.
In terms of like when you live in a city, you got no choice. You don't want to drive a car, number one, because you sit in traffic, you pollute the air, you waste a lot of money, you waste too much gas. And, you know, public transportation, in my head, very exciting.
It is exciting. I've always loved the New York City subway system. Loved it.
And, like, you know, like when I take a cab or a car in the middle of the night, you know, that's something I got to do because there's no other way to get here. I don't have a car here.
Yeah.
You know, but when you get on public transportation, this is one thing that people should envy about our city, is it's something very exciting to be part of New York because you almost feel like you're a cell in a giant organism and everybody's working together to get where they're going and to make everything function properly. Some people think that New Yorkers are these angry, freaked out people. And it's, you know what? If we are, it's not, we're not walking around yelling. We have to manage a certain amount of tolerance because you coexist with people right up on your head all the time. There's always someone right next to you. And I enjoy that part of this city. I enjoy part of being that vigorous sort of, you know, movement of people in this city. It's very exciting.
It is very exciting. And people have to understand the scale that we're talking about here. Each New York City 10-car subway train holds 2,000 people.
It's unbelievable.
It's an amazing thing.
You ever go to the burbs, man? You go out into mall land where people got to drive 20 miles to get to where they work to sit in a cubicle with people that they see every day that hardly ever talk to.
Most of whom they hate.
Right, and then they get back in their car and go home. The isolation of, you know, I believe that New York is a vital place in a lot of cities that you can't underestimate the cities that, you know, they are vital places where people really deal with each other
in
a very intimate and exciting way in terms of tolerance, respect. I mean, this is the safest city I've ever lived in. I've lived in Los Angeles. I've lived in San Francisco. Anywhere where people got to drive around, you never know. They could be driving around with guns. They could be driving around. They could be driving around drunk. The one thing you know about New York is you can see the guy right there. You're both going to the same place. No one's driving with a gun. You know, no one's going to pull up beside you and take you out. I just noticed that about like San Francisco and L.A. specifically, that I feel safer here because at any given point in time in New York, you can go, buddy, can you help me out?
Yeah.
And somebody will.
Somebody will. Absolutely. You know, it is one of the great things about living in New York and riding the subway. I used to ride the subway out to like Coney Island in Brooklyn sometimes.
I've done that before, just to do it.
Yeah, just to do it. Exactly. Just to do it.
You're like there's you and two other people on the car and it's going 100 miles an hour. Sometimes you get those drivers. When I go onto the river in the Queens, you're like sitting there going, how fast is this guy going to go? You know what I mean?
Do you know that until recently they didn't have speedometers on New York City subway? They didn't know how fast they were going.
Go by the feel and by the lights, man. If you got a green, go.
Keep going. The yellow, just slow down a little.
All right, we're going to come back in a second and talk about Iraq and some horrible things that we're all worked up and we're excited about. Good things. We'll have 5 minutes to regroup and regroove. But it's interesting stuff. There is some stuff going on there that a lot of people don't know about. There's stuff within the intelligence community that just broke this morning that people will be surprised to hear. It's 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion.
Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, how can we stop the neocon death cult with their zombie brigades? Their Christo-fascist zombie brigades. Pretty soon they're going to start issuing all of them these sort of, you know, the Fuhrer waistcoat that was designed for the president. His little strange kind of futuristic-looking, fascistic, epauletted, you know, neocon death cult waistcoat.
Why is he wearing a jacket with epaulettes? I mean, did somebody tell him, look, you know, it'll look just like military?
The scary thing is that, you know, he had it designed for him. He has said, like, you know, I want a military-looking piece of leisure wear that I can wear when I speak to troops. It's only a matter of time before he has one made for all times. You know, he's going to be one of those guys who's just going to be walking around in military garb. I guess he's entitled to. He's the commander-in-chief, the fraudulent commander-in-chief, but nonetheless, all he's got to do is say, how about somebody make me a military uniform that's unlike anyone else's, because I'm the king. Anyways, speaking of military, Ramon came in and brought us Donald Rumsfeld's palm pilot. He slipped under the door, and oddly, he was wearing a similar waistcoat. I don't know if you can get him, but here's a Rumsfeld's schedule. 0600, wake up shouting every snappy comeback I should have said to those whiny, ungrateful soldiers in Kuwait. Nobody talks to the man fifth in line for the presidency that way. 0630, dig through Iraqi landfills for scrap metal to use as vehicle armor. Show those spoiled punks how a real man scavenges for compromised ballistic glass. 0800, ignore complaints that the regular army is given priority over National Guard troops. Note, intra-squad rivalry is healthy. Toughens them up. They need it. 1230, have everyone in a 100-foot radius drop and give me 20, because I said so. 1330, looking at renaming stop-loss program the start-win program. 1800, buy more Humvees. Tell dealer we do not need our rides pimped. All right, speaking of this, now, yeah, okay, new intelligence reform part is passing. There are some shortcomings to the bill, obviously. It was relatively bipartisan, but not really. But one of the concerns of the Republicans initially was, like, this is going to put a
compromise.
It's going to compromise the chain of command. It's going to compromise our troops on the ground. But look at this. This is before any reform whatsoever. A senior CIA operative who handled sensitive informants in Iraq asserts that CIA managers asked him to falsify his reporting on weapons of mass destruction and retaliated against him after he refused. So listen to this quote. The CIA management planned to get him for his role in reporting intelligence contrary to official CIA dogma. Now, first of all, the Central Intelligence Agency is not supposed to have dogma, all right? And this guy sort of validates every of our worst fears.
Yeah.
That they bullied, they coerced, they bullied the CIA to give them information that fit their desire to go into Iraq. False information. Now, first of all, that doesn't compromise the troops on the ground right from the get-go. And now that it's validated that this stuff was pushed through, you know, without any real credibility, it's very disturbing.
Well, it is very disturbing. And see, remember that during this same period that this CIA officer is talking about, that was the time when Dick Cheney was going out to Langley telling the CIA what kind of intelligence they wanted at the White House.
Right, so Rumsfeld and his boys could have their little party in Iraq, so the neocon death cult can do their little free market experiment at the expense of our guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now, you know, you got Rumsfeld, you know, on the pulpit yesterday, on the death pulpit, talking to real soldiers. You know, can we hear that sound number one there, Chris? Yeah, take your time. There's this specialist, Thomas Wilson. All right, he asked Rumsfeld. Go ahead.
Our soldiers have been fighting in Iraq for coming up on 3 years. A lot of us are getting ready to move north relatively soon. Our vehicles are not armored. We're digging pieces of rusted scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass that's already been shot up, dropped, busted, picking the best out of this scrap to put onto our vehicles to take into combat.
And what did the neocon death cult representative respond back to him there, Chris?
Since the Iraq conflict began, the Army has been pressing ahead.
Waffling.
To produce the armor necessary at a rate that they believe, it's a greatly expanded rate from what existed previously, but a rate that they believe is the rate that is all that can be accomplished at this moment.
Yeah, and he also said you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have. What kind of BS is that? We're supposed to have the best army. We shouldn't be there to begin with, but these guys get in thinking that they're at least, if it's an army of one, they didn't think they were going to have to bring their own gear. You know, it's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing, but Mark, think about what he just said.
Yeah.
What he said distilled was, well, the army is saying that this is the best they can do, that this is the most we can manufacture, this is the largest number of machines that we can put out with the proper armament.
And then he actually says to me, he acts like he doesn't really know exactly what's going on.
Exactly.
Fighting for his life to hold on to $40 billion so he can run these guys' lives and not give them the right equipment. And now we've got homeless guys, you know, homeless vets from this war showing up on the streets of America. There's already 300,000, you know, homeless vets on any given day in this country. And then we've got this kid who's trying to get asylum in Canada, and he's trying to get it because he left because, you know, he felt that the war was unjust and he didn't want to be part of it. And we have a guest that we once had on our show, this guy Jimmy Massey,
yeah,
who is who was a very powerful, he's a former staff sergeant,
yes,
who was in Iraq. He talked to us in May, and he's actually vouching for this cat who wants to get asylum in
Canada. He testified on his behalf in Canada. Yeah,
this is Jeremy Heinzman, who we also talked to at another point in time. So after the break, you know, we will definitely hear that that piece of Jimmy Massey interview. But to me, you know, given that this was the premise of this war was a lie, and now they don't even equip the guys properly, and which we've known for a long time, Rumsfeld waffles around, backpedals, and actually, you know, this guy Wilson had the guts to really ask the questions that need to be asked, and Rumsfeld rationalizes. He actually said, quote, you can have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can still be blown up. What the hell does that even mean? Well, why don't you guys just take your clothes off and run around?
It means he probably's never been in a tank in his life.
I just can't believe it. Now, wait till you hear this Jimmy Massey piece we have from May, because it ties right into what we're talking about, and then we're going to go to
about the courts, another place Bush has put under assault.
Oh, my God.
It's terrible.
My head's about to bleed.
We'll be right back here on Air America Radio.
Sedition, fighting treason with reason on Air America Radio.
Hey, what's going on? 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Good morning.
We've got our guest, Nan Aaron, is coming up in a second when we get her on the phone. But I want to flesh this out. This guy, Jeremy Heinzman, who is in Canada asking for asylum, is essentially there because he deserted and he felt reprisal by the military if he returned home. And the reason that he deserted was because he says he fled the U.S. military because he believed the invasion of Iraq was illegal and any violent acts he committed there would be unconscionable. He said, quote, this was a criminal war, end quote. Any act of violence would be unjustified conflict in this atrocity, is what Heinzman, who is 26 years old, he deserted his regiment in January just days before being deployed to Iraq and fears he will be unfairly court-martialed. Now, the guy who came in, who stepped in for him to sort of, you know, give him credibility is a guy who's been there, who's been to Iraq, former Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey, who we talked to in May, and we just wanted to play a segment of this interview, and then we'll move on from this. But this is powerful stuff. It's one of the few interviews that Riley and I have had.
It shook us up.
Yeah. Let's hear that from May. This is me talking to Jimmy Massey. And what was the event that was sort of where you had this, you know, this completely change of heart, this change of mind about what you were doing there?
Right. Well, I was just outside, on the outskirts of Baghdad. There was an incident that was near the Baghdad stadium, and we had opened fire on a vehicle that came into our red zone, which was our zone that we opened fire. After we had opened fire on this vehicle, we went over and pulled the occupants out. Three of them were fatally wounded. They were dying. We called the medics, and they came over and started doing reviving resuscitation on them. However, one of the Iraqis that was in the car, he was unscathed, and he walked up to me. He knew that obviously I was in some sort of command. And he walked up to me and he said, "Why did you shoot us? You know, why did you kill my brother?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do anything to you. We're not terrorists." That was the turning point.
These guys, you know, it's like, it's so amazing to hear these guys talk, and this is in a war that didn't have to happen,
That's the thing.
And all these cats are coming back after doing stuff like that. Some of them, you know, have drug problems, some of them can't handle the stress of it, and there's more, there's now new homeless veterans entering the world, entering the streets. And then you talk about that CIA cat who was going unnamed and accusing the CIA of bullying him to give false information about weapons of mass destruction, and now they're taking action against him, trying to slander his name. You know, this neocon death cult is about the worst thing that ever happened to this planet, and I hope we recover from it. You know, and I, you know, this war is going on. There's no indication that's going to stop. And now what they want to do with the Supreme Court, now that that a couple of these people are leaving the Supreme Court, and what they want to do with textbooks and everything else. I mean, this is a full-on onslaught of you know, world-changing crap that, you know, it's like, I hope they run us into a ground to the point in the next 4 years to where people wake up and say, you know what, we got rooked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I just hope that happens. But to talk about the Supreme Court right now, joining us by phone is, you know, she is the president of Alliance for Justice. Her group's accomplishments include helping to defeat Robert Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court in 1987 and organizing the effort that helped support an unprecedented 6 Senate filibusters in 2003 against President George W. Bush and his most extreme judicial nominees. Please welcome Nan Aaron to the show. Good morning, Nan.
I wish it was a stage.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Take the mic, Nan. Spotlight.
And congratulations for coming to Washington, D.C.
Are we there finally? Thank God.
We've just read about it in our Washington Post this morning.
I wish somebody had told us. Maybe we should have got that press release before you did. I really appreciate you being here. So now that the election is over, what's going to happen with the Supreme Court? We're all kind of freaked out. What do you think?
Well, I do think that the inevitable is about to happen, and that is we will see at least one, but probably several vacancies to the Supreme Court. You know, we've gone an unprecedented 10 years in this country without a vacancy, but it's clear that with some of the justices ailing, and particularly with Chief Justice Rehnquist's current illness, that it's very likely that even sooner rather than later, we will see a real shakeup at the court.
So what does that mean for us? So given that this president doesn't do anything in any real bipartisan way, I mean, is he going to consult Senator Leahy on the Judiciary Committee? What's going to happen?
You know, he certainly should, because if he were to engage in meaningful consultation with some of these Democratic senators, President Bush could ensure that his nominees would really sail through the process. It's the way President Clinton picked judges.
Mm-hmm.
Both his Supreme Court picks, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, were agreed upon by both the Democrats as well as Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican, leading Republican in the United States Senate. And, of course, they both had a very easy confirmation. I don't think, however, that this president cares about reaching across the political divide. He has shown absolutely no interest in doing this. All of his nominees have been chosen exclusively by him. And I believe that the Democrats will continue to stand up to him and filibuster his nominees until he sits down with the Democrats and actually comes up and with a set of agreed-upon names by mm-hmm. both parties.
What's to stop some of his nominees from simply going through the confirmation process without really revealing anything about themselves or as little about themselves as possible? If they don't have a long history in terms of, you know, their judicial record, won't there be quite a bit of pressure on the Democrats to approve them if they, for example, won't say that they what their position is on abortion?
Yes, there will be enormous pressure on both sides to confirm. And, of course, everyone's looking for that one candidate without what we call a paper trail, that paper trail that resulted in the defeat of Robert Bork for the Supreme Court. But something has changed over the past 4 years, and that is the Democrats have been engaged in a process whereby they ask questions and demand the answers. And if the answers aren't provided, as in the case of Miguel Estrada, the Democrats have simply said, you know what, we don't know enough about your views. You're going to a lifetime appointment on a very influential court. You'll be there long after President Bush leaves office. And you know what? What you're doing is too important for us to confirm you without our knowing more. So I do think the senators, particularly with a Supreme Court nomination, are going to ask the tough questions. And if they don't, we Americans have to demand that they ask the questions as well as get the answers.
This is all assuming that Bush doesn't declare himself emperor in the next 3 years. I guess it's pretty much assumed that Scalia will be the Chief Justice, yes?
No, I don't think we can assume that.
Okay.
certainly rumors to that effect that when the Chief Justice steps down, that Bush might well select Scalia or actually Clarence Thomas to fill his seat. And in fact, George Bush has said often in the past that the two justices he admires most are Scalia and Thomas. But it's very, very hard to predict. I would think that Bush might want to elevate those two, but I think both present problems even for the Republicans.
Does Thomas really doesn't have a great deal of paper on him since he's been a justice? I mean, he doesn't really write a lot of the opinions, does he?
Well, there's a lot we know about Justice Thomas. Even though he's not the most active participant on the Supreme Court, he's clearly the right-wing anchor on that court. He is even more to the right than Antonin Scalia, which means...
Is that possible?
on the environment, consumer protection, death penalty, equal pay issues, he is always, always writing dissent or joining opinions harmful to the very issues that most Americans care about. But the same is true with Scalia. Absolutely. The thing in Scalia's case is, in addition to writing opinions that jeopardize our rights and protections, he also has a significant number of ethical problems, as Harry Reid hinted about over during his TV show over last weekend.
So I ask this before you go, a quick question. I ask this to people that can speculate about things big like yourself. Is there hope?
Yes, there is hope.
Okay, good.
You know, let me just tell you why. In 2 seconds.
Okay.
If the Democrats vote down harmful nominees, extremist nominees,
yes,
they will eventually have to put enough pressure on this administration to come up with more moderate nominees, but they've got to be willing to do it, and do it more than just once.
Okay. Thank you, Nan Aaron.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Good beat to go out on.
And congratulations.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. 866-303-2270. If you've got something you want to add to this conversation, please call us about any of the topics we talked about today. The military, the CIA, the Supreme Court, New York City's public transportation. Man, there's no end to it. 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Call 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
All right, folks, 50 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America. We're going to try and land this thing. We've only got a few minutes. Let's get right to the calls. Who do we got? That's Ted in Nebraska. How are you? How are you, Ted?
Mark.
Hey, Ted.
Hi, Mark and Mark. You know, you liberals are constantly putting down our military leaders without actually having any respect.
Happening. Oh, no. I hate when... help me, Riley. Oh, my God. Oh, no. It's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
And now, live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservatives' way to wake up with Mark the Shark Maron.
Good morning, neocons! It's 20 after the hour here on Radio Halliburton. Halliburton, you can put a price tag on freedom. That's right, baseball players are on steroids, but W's got them on the run. Hey, Barry Bonds, you're a cleanup hitter. Clean that up. I'm Barry Bonds' testicles. I'm drinking, no! What's the matter, liberals? Gotta have drugs to play baseball? Here's Mark the Shark's national pastime. Strike three, juice heads. I'm gonna need a relief pitcher. Oh, whoa, whoa, squeeze play. Mark the Shark almost laid down a bunt. Oh, no, hey, they counted the votes again in Ohio, and guess what?
Game over, man.
That's
game
right, liberals. You lose again. Loser, 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 loser. Yeah. Eat that. Oh, whoops. Eat that, Democrat. Hey, it's 22 after the hour. Let's take a call. You're on the air, caller.
Oh, those damn liberals.
That's right.
Nazis, Texas.
That's right.
Tonight, baby killers.
That's right.
Chickens, Martin.
That's right.
From Dance Channel.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. What do you got for me? Give it to me. Whoa. Hey. It's 24 after the hour. Time for the Neocon Power Weather Forecast. Looks like it's going to be a white Christmas for most of America, except for Massachusetts. Oh, it's going to be pink. Don, we know our gay apparel. Don, we know our gay apparel. Ziggy pudding. Stick around, Neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Don't touch that dial, Patriot. We'll be back with Right and Early.
Wow. What happened?
You okay?
I don't know.
You all right?
I hate when I black out. I got to get that fixed. I think I got a tumor or something. All right, let's take a call here. Harold, how are you? Harold, you're listening at Edwin Air Force Base in Florida on XM. Nice to talk to you. What's going on?
Hey, Harold.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind, man?
Nothing. I'm just, you know, want to comment on these weak Democratic leaders that, you know, I voted for Kerry, and nobody's taking Rumsfeld to task about what's going on in the ground in Iraq, especially with the little town hall meeting he had talking about you go to war with the army you have, not the army you need.
What is that about, right?
Well, hell, we didn't need this war.
That's right. That's for sure. And that guy had some serious nads on him, that Wilson.
Yeah.
And another thing is my wife is currently, she's over there, and I'm a single father here, and I'm just thinking, you know, what in the hell am I going to tell my kids if, God forbid, if anything happens,
yeah,
you know? And, you know, that to me, that was just disrespectful, you know, go to war with the army that you have. Well, hell, we wish we had another Secretary of Defense who gave a damn about the truth.
That's absolutely right, man.
You're right.
And I hope everything works out, and I hope the best. And we're putting what you said out there, and I think you're right. I wish some Democrats would stand up to this guy.
Yeah, Godspeed to your wife, too. Let's hope she gets home safe.
Yeah, thanks for your call, man. Matt in St. Paul, how are you?
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Mark and Mark.
What's going on?
If you look at the color of the tunic that Bush wore
out at
Pemberton,
yeah,
you know what? It's the exact same color as Augustus Pinochet's uniform back in 1988, 87, 86, when Pinochet was disappearing people.
And oddly,
now, there's a conspiracy theory for you.
And his uniform, Bush's, means the exact same thing that Pinochet's did.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And here's what they ought to do. You've seen on the Internet this montage of photos where Bush has an expression, and then they put a chimpanzee next to it with the exact same expression.
There's, yeah,
about 20 photos. You've probably seen that. They ought to do the same thing for uniforms and get Franco, a picture of Franco there, and a picture of Pinochet, and a picture of Marcos,
yeah,
and then a picture of Bush next to each one and send it out on the Internet. I don't have the skills for it, but somebody ought to do it.
Well, I think that just you saying that, I imagine somebody will do
somebody
it.
Somebody will
and
do
if
it
you
now,
do
yeah.
do it, send it over to Morning Sedition. Thanks for your call, Matt. Nice to talk to you. Mike in Brooklyn, how are you?
Hey, Mike.
Mike?
Mike?
Yeah, how you doing?
All right, what's up, man?
What's going on?
Not much. I tell you, I wanted to make a comment. The lady says the Democrats have to be willing to stand up to them. And it seems like they've proven over and over again that they're not willing to stand up to them. They have too much to lose, you know? They're not like guys like me that have already lost it all. They're millionaires. The changes these people are going to put in won't really affect them, but they're going to devastate me. So do they want to risk their political careers, their lives, fighting this guy? Because even if we win, they'll lose. They've proven, the Republicans have proven, that they can be vicious and they will go after you no matter what.
Well, Mike,
they will destroy you.
Mike, if you got nothing to do, get down there. Go and talk to these people. He's absolutely right. I do hope, like Nan said, that they had the courage, that some of these guys,
yeah,
have the wherewithal to do it, to bring a little Howard Dean into their lives, to bring a little stand up for what you believe in as opposed to stand up for yourself.
A little fire.
I hope so. I don't know, you know. But I do want to say we'll be in Boston tomorrow,
yeah,
Somerville, Davis Square, Someday Cafe. We're going to be broadcasting live. Our guests are going to be Congressman Barney Frank, comedian Jimmy Tingle, comedian Barry Crimmins, musician Ted Leo. It's going to be a blast. Come by, even if it's raining or snowing, it doesn't matter. Have a cup of coffee. Hang out. We'll give you a keychain. We'll give you a kiss. We'll give you a T-shirt while supplies last.
There you go.
And it depends who you want to kiss you. But I can't promise the kisses because I might get into trouble. But
yeah, we're both married guys, you know.
Yeah, we are. Well, you know, just a peck maybe or on the hand. All right. And Friday night, I will be at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square as part of the Ding Ho Reunion, 25 years of the best of Boston comedy. Go to the tour dates section of morningsedition.com for ticket info. And I'm looking forward to it, man.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
There's a liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, kiddies. One, use a fire hose to flood Santa's village at the mall and shout, "The real North Pole is melting from the effects of greenhouse gases." Two, try to wring the last drops of irony out of headlines that juxtapose George W. Bush with intelligence reform. I say make a T-shirt and send it to us. We've got a stack of those. Three, point out the subtle sexism in the fact that there are 12 lords a-leaping, but only 11 ladies dancing. What up with that, dog?
Yeah.
Four, liberate your town's Christmas tree, leaving behind a sign that says, "Tinsel equals slavery." And five, phrase of the day, you know those Christmas toys are all made with underpaid elf labor, man. Wake up! They're keeping us asleep! Wake up!
Beantown!
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow!
We're going to get the train today.
Get the train today. Be there or be square. Come on, Boston, come see us!
Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, man.
All right, buddy.